Good morning, everyone. I never get tired of the blessing from Word and Life because my life has truly been blessed by this community. Never would I have the courage, and it's still hard for me to stand up here and talk, but never would I have had the courage to do it without all of you who think I have something worth saying. So thank you very much. I'd like to start this morning, and those of you who know me know silence is a big part of my spiritual path and my spiritual practice. It is my spiritual practice. So I'd like to start this morning with some silence. We're going to be led into the silence by a meditation by Deepak Chopra. It's very short. And then we'll have about 3 minutes of silence. Then I'll bring the silence to a close with some verses from Psalm 107.
Relax your body. Observe your breath as it goes in and out. Now move your awareness into the area of your heart. Be grateful. You, my friend, are not your thoughts. You are the thinker of the thoughts. The thoughts come from you. So where are you? You are in the stillness, the silence between your thoughts. That stillness, that silence is you.
Peace dwells in the heart of silence. Compassion and mercy abide there as well. Come, let us give thanks to the heart of all hearts, giving praise for the unlimited gifts of love. Let us pray for the good of all life and learn to dance in harmony with the cosmos. For we are invited to radiate divine presence, to be blessing to one another. Thus do we become the very image that we reflect. Whoever is wise, let them ponder these things. Let all people reflect on the gifts of the Beloved. Amen. Well, good morning again. Tom, do you think maybe we could raise the lights a little bit now? Or it doesn't work that way, huh? Oh dear. Okay. No, that's okay. No, it's fine. This is all right. Oh, it's all right. Yeah, it'll. I think it'll be too much of a glare for the people. No, no. This is fine. It's actually all right, as long as everybody doesn't mind it. All right. How many were here for Greg Boyle last week? Well, that's a hard act to follow. So he actually raises the bar so high that you can't even begin to rise to that level. So I feel a little more comfortable just, you know, whatever I have to say this morning. My five loaves and two fish, I like to say. It's all I have. Here's how this morning's going to go. I hope to talk until about 10 to 11 and then open it up for some questions. And then after the break, actually the room was originally, I had hoped, going to be set up in tables so you'd be around tables. But during the break, maybe we'll scatter the tables about. And after the break, I want you to have a chance to share. I hope that you read this chapter. And Judy Cannato has really wonderful meditative questions at the end of the chapter. So I thought we'd have a chance to share on those questions for that whole second half, give you a chance to hear the input from each other. So that's how this morning is going to go. So I want to start by acknowledging our author, Judy Cannato. I never met Judy, but if she was still alive, I'm sure I would have met her by now because we have a friend in common. But Judy was an author, a retreat facilitator, a spiritual director, best known for her work connecting the new cosmology with Christian spirituality, especially in her books Radical Amazement and Field of Compassion, which we're studying. She was diagnosed with cancer while writing this book, which she speaks about in the last chapter. The diagnosis, she says, was a defining moment in her life. The experience led her to, in her words, shed belief about reality and to trust what was in her heart. And that was the reality of the grace that was sustaining her through the comfort of friends and family. She wanted to approach this time with integrity, and she did. She died of cancer on May 7, 2011. So I'd like to dedicate my time this morning to her and hope that I speak with the integrity with which she lived her life. So anyhow, I wanted to make sure that we acknowledged her. And then I want to talk a little bit about the approach to the book and the study in general, and I said this before, but what's really important to me always is the more that's going on. This isn't about a book or what Judy Cannato thinks or what I think or what any of the speakers think, but it includes all that. What it's about more, in my mind, is what's happening to you inside yourself, in your heart and in your mind. When you read the book, when you listen to speakers, what's going on with you? Because that's where the encounter comes between you and the more than you, between you and God, or however you want to name that power within inside ourselves greater than us. So pay attention. It's not about people being right or wrong or agreeing or disagreeing, but pay attention to what's happening as you listen. That is the way I think you'll benefit most, and that this study will have the most opportunity to help you actually change your life. And that's what we hope. We hope that with each book and with each study and with each speaker, you come away a different person, either thinking differently or acting differently in your life. Transformation is what it's about, not information. So I know we all know that, but I want to remind you so you listen gently to me today and take away what is important for you and what isn't, just leave behind. So I'm assigned to the first chapter, which is the significance of story. Well, I don't think, if you listened to Greg Boyle last week, I don't think anybody has to be convinced about the significance of story. You know, we listen to stories all the time, and even in the last semester, Don George used two wonderful stories to talk about compassion. The Life of Pi, I think it was, and the story of Percival and the Grail King. So, and last semester, how many of you were here to hear Dennis Apple speak? Well, you know, when you hear a story like that, I mean, a lived story where faith and life come together in such a powerful way to transform a person, you can't help but be changed yourself. So I don't think any of us really have to be convinced about the power of story. I remember hearing Don Hewitt, who's the producer of 60 Minutes, when asked what he attributed his 40-year success with. He says, it's simple. The formula is simple. It's reduced to four words every kid in the world knows. Tell me a story. It's that easy. So Richard Rohr says that any healthy spirituality is a conversation between three stories: my story, our story, and the story. So in other words, we're always really conversing with those stories, I think. And if we're not, then we're probably not all that healthy. If it's only about us and our story, and then we're leaving a huge part of it out in order to help ourselves grow. So our story is just the raw material of our lives, who we are, our gender, where we live, what defines us. And then our story are the larger story, the families we live in, the communities we belong to, the cities we live in, and the widening circles. And then these stories is the story that really gives meaning to and defines the other stories. So a healthy spirituality is always in conversation with those three stories. And I do believe that that's true, and I think most of us are in conversation with those stories all the time. Maybe we just don't realize it. And so in this book, Field of Compassion, what Judy sets herself out to do is to bring together two stories that have been divorced for a long time. Not just separated, but I think actually divorced. And that is the religious story and the scientific story. I call that divorce the mother of all divorce, because I think that divorce between spirit and matter, God and creation, is really underlies all the separations that we experience in this world. And if we could bring these two stories together, which belong together, they're married to each other, really. And I think the violence is when we keep trying to separate them and say that they're not. So in this book, this is what she's trying to do, to bring these two together and to help it become a living story in which we now participate in a greater degree. And we're helping by participating in this story to actually co-create our future. So that's what she's setting out to do. So I'd like to talk personally. I hope my talk will be a little conversation between all these three stories. Also, talk about the religious story and how it came alive for me, and then the scientific story. Let there be light. And she said, let there be light. Oh! It was nothing, really. Okay. The religious story. Well, I grew up in the religious story. It was very important to me from the time I was little. I was raised a Catholic, all through Catholic schools. I loved my Catholic education. I loved the nuns. They loved me. And I was a good Catholic girl. So the religious story was really very important and basic to my life. I loved God. That's why I came to Word in Life. I was looking for God deeper in my life. So here I was at Word in Life, and we were doing Bible study. And the first 4 years, it was really a story that I objectively was reading. But at the same time, I'm living my life in my family, raising teenagers and growing my relationship with my husband. And so we were studying Isaiah, and there was lots of tension going on at home. And, of course, I'm reading all this blood and guts and gore in Isaiah. And all of a sudden, really, it broke open. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this isn't just happening like 2,500 years ago. this is my story. This is happening now. And I began to make a connection between what was going on between, you know, Israel and God and what was going on in my family. And so every chapter would either be a challenge to me to act in a certain way, or if I was particularly distressed, here would come a chapter, comfort, oh, comfort my people, and I would be comforted. And so I found myself in the story. And it wasn't that I was back in the time of Isaiah in Israel. I was here, in the 21st century as myself, but it was the same story. So once the story came alive for me, I could never not read it and find myself in it. So when we were studying the Gospel of Luke, and we were doing the chapter on Jesus' baptism in the Jordan, and I was reflecting on that for the whole week, and what I was really reflecting on was Jesus as a human and the human experience that he was having. And I think this is something that at the time, you know, was coming new to Word and Life. We were so indoctrinated with Jesus as divine, as the second person of the Blessed Trinity, the only Son of God, that we have really marginalized who he was as a human being. So I was trying, through my own circumstances in my life, trying to understand why he went to be baptized in the Jordan in the first place, why he followed John the Baptist, what his life must have been like as a human Jesus, taking away the fact that he's God, what was passed on to him by Mary and Joseph, and the struggle, because I was feeling a struggle in my relationship with God. I felt called out, but I'm here in my family life. And so when he was baptized, to me it was a surrender. It was a surrender to God that I'm just a human being. He felt called out, but he didn't feel any different than anybody. And so I'm reflecting on this, and all of a sudden it opened up for me. And I somehow surrendered myself, and coming up out of that experience, I lost myself in this experience, and coming up out of it, when it says the heavens opened up and he heard the word, you are my beloved, in whom I'm well pleased, well, that he was raised up into a whole new consciousness of who he was. And so was I. So was I. I wasn't Jesus. I was me, but I was having the same experience. And once you have that experience, it's really difficult to put words on it. But everything belongs, everything's equal, everything's loved, nothing's left behind, lost, or forgotten. Everything belongs, everything's included. Richard Rohr says, you can't think your way into union with God. You must also experience it. This is an encounter of such immensity that everything else shifts in position. There's no need to exclude or eliminate others, because union involves radical inclusivity, something much bigger. This union makes you glad to be common and ordinary, servants of all, and just like everybody else, because any need for specialness has been met once and for all. So that type of experience, and you can see it in Jesus' life, you come out of that experience into a world that doesn't mirror it. So you try to start drawing people in, which is what Jesus did. He comes out of this experience into a totally divided world where everybody doesn't belong, in a religion that sets up exclusivity. And so you go trying to gather it in so that you can visibly see the manifestation of what you have internally experienced. And so it's the same thing happened for me. I came out of that into a religious tradition that was more about excluding than including, and it became a struggle for me and very difficult. So I went looking in the tradition for support. When I went back to school, one of my professors suggested that I might like Teilhard de Chardin, who is a French Jesuit paleontologist. So I read him and I fell in love with him, and I wrote my thesis on him. And I wish Judy Cannata was here, because I would like to ask her why she chose Karl Rahner as her theologian of choice and not Teilhard de Chardin. Amazing. And the only conclusion I could come up with, and I asked this friend of hers, who's also a friend of mine, and she said it's probably because she was being published by a Catholic publisher for whom Karl Rahner would have been a much more substantial theologian, and because Teilhard would send up some red flags, certainly in his theology. And it's kind of sad to me, but I understand how compromises have to be made when in life. But honestly, and I've read Karl Rahner, and the interesting thing is Karl Rahner and Teilhard de Chardin come to the same conclusions, but they come at it from an entirely different way. Karl Rahner's a systematic theologian, and Teilhard de Chardin's a scientist. And the reason why I like Teilhard was because Teilhard's starting point was his human experience in nature. He, from the time he was little, his father was sort of an amateur scientist and collected fossils and encouraged the children to do that, while at the same time his mother was a very devout Catholic with a great devotion to the Sacred Heart. So here he has these two influences, but really nature. He lived in a beautiful section, I guess, of France where they had a lot of volcanic rock and different types of rock formations. And so from the time he was 5 years old, he said when his mother cut his hair and a lock fell in the fire and burnt up, he realized he was perishable, you know, that he wasn't going to last. And so he went looking for something in nature because he loved nature. There must be something solid, something, you know, imperishable in nature. So he started collecting little pieces of iron and, you know, bolts and lock pins. And he had this little collection that he left under the porch, I guess, one day when it was a rainy day, and they all rusted. And he said he threw himself on the lawn and shed the bitterest tears of his life because his gods of iron had rusted. So here it wasn't going to be iron. So then it said a little later he stubbed his toe on a rock and he picked it up and loved it. And that began his love of rocks because that was solid. But you can see where he's coming from. He was looking for God in life, in nature. And I connected with him because I was doing the same thing. I was looking for God in my everyday life. You know, Paula D'Arcy, a spiritual retreat leader and author, says, God comes disguised as your life. And so God is in your life. If God isn't in your life, where is God? And so the reason I like Teilhard is because this whole struggle then for him between God and the world. Because in his day, and I think it's still true in our day, the spirituality was otherworldly. It wasn't about this world. It was about what you had to do in this world to get to the next world, which, you know, was a higher world. So he really struggled with that, and especially with his vocation to the priesthood, because if he became a priest, then he'd have to give up his science. And he loved them both. He loved them immensely. So he finally decided he did have a call to the priesthood, so he was going to give up his science. And it was in about his third year in seminary. He was on a retreat weekend, and he had this breakthrough, and he couldn't do it. And these are the words he wrote. You thought you could do without it, without matter, without the material world, because the power of thought had been kindled in you. You hoped the more thoroughly you rejected the tangible, the closer you would be to spirit, that you would be more divine if you lived in a world of pure thought, or at least angelic if you fled the corporeal. Well, you were likely to have perished of hunger. Never say matter is accursed. Matter is evil. Purity does not lie in separation from, but in a deeper penetration into the universe. Bathe yourself in an ocean of matter. Plunge into it where it is deepest and most violent. Struggle in its currents and drink of its waters, for it cradled you long ago in your pre-conscious existence, and it is that ocean that will raise you up to God. God in the world, that he couldn't. And luckily he had enough spiritual advisors that said he could do both. He could pursue his science and still be a priest, which he did. But so at that time, he was familiar with Darwin's theory of evolution, but he didn't like it because it was too random, too much chance, absolutely no meaning, no goal, no direction. Because he was a scientist, he was attracted to the idea of evolution, but he didn't like Darwin's evolution. So then he read a book by Henry Bergson called Creative Evolution. And what Henry Bergson was saying is the pattern of evolution is imbued with what he called an élan vital, a vital force. There's a vital force in the evolutionary process always bringing order out of chaos. And that opened it up for Teilhard. That's what he was looking for, the spirit of evolution, not just a flat. There was another separation there between, you know, the world and God. So he said that through the lens of evolution, the dualism of matter and spirit, body and soul, dissolved before him like fog before the rising sun. So once you do embrace this, then, and this is the subtitle to the book, How the New Cosmology is Changing Our Understanding of Our Faith. Well, it isn't really in institutional religion, but, and I can only speak to it on how it changed my faith. And Teilhard, and this is the difference between he and Rahner, I think, is that Rahner was trying to fit traditional theological categories into evolution, but Teilhard was speaking out of the evolution itself, and it changed everything. And the biggest change was that creation isn't finished yet. There couldn't possibly have been in an evolutionary history a prehistory before, you know, the Big Bang or whatever got it started. So he, for him, he called it a cosmogenesis, a universe in the process of becoming. We're not finished yet. And, you know, that resonates with me. We're not finished yet because collectively, what he would say is to create is to unite. And if we're not fully united, we're not fully created. So there's more work to do. It's this in-gathering so that we can look out and see this internal coming together of God and creation. So, of course, he got in trouble for that because the whole understanding of original sin, which he thought was the greatest obstacle to the progress of Christianity, he just couldn't hold to. It got him in trouble. He got taken away from his teaching post and sort of exiled to scientific work then in China. So one of the things that Teilhard, in his theory of evolution, he saw called the formation of the Earth, the geosphere, then life on Earth, the biosphere, and then human life coming through us. And then the next stage of evolution for him was what he called the noosphere, N-O-O-S-P-H-E-R-E. And it comes from a Greek word meaning to know. So he saw what he called a thinking envelope around the Earth that would only come through what he called the human phenomenon. The Phenomenon of Man was one of his biggest books. And the reason the human is a phenomenon is because we're the only species that has the ability to self-reflect. In other words, we know that we know. And so thought is creating this invisible web around the Earth. And so he actually predicted, without even knowing it, the Internet. you know, I mean, it's the information. I mean, we are, you know, the networking. So I wish he was alive today, and he would be able to contribute so much to what is actually happening in all the sciences. What he felt was, he didn't feel that it was worth the effort, or we would find out what we wanted to know about ourselves by looking backwards. Because at that time, science, you know, they hadn't split the atom. You couldn't go back far. He says if you want to know who you are, you want to know about yourself, look to where you're going. And so he looked out in the world and said, well, the world is becoming smaller. We're moving closer together. The world is trying to unite. Well, if that's the direction that we're going, it must have been where we came from. So that's what he would say. This whole new envelope of thought and connection is moving towards a unity that then will mirror the unity from which we came. So the Alpha and he called that the Omega point. So Alpha and Omega were the same for him. So it's a return home, so to speak. So I want to talk a little bit about, because I made the connection then between what we're studying about, the field of compassion. So this thinking envelope is a field, and we're going to get into it next week, the scientific theory of fields, fields within fields. But and she's going to work up, Judy, in her book to compassion being a field. And just briefly about field theory that you're going to hear more about next week and read about in the book. And her book is really reader-friendly with the science that she presents. And this is why I suggested the book, because I think it's very important to, and there are other Catholic theologians that are talking about this, but none as reader-friendly as, I think, Judy. A morphogenetic field, that's the term, morphogenetic field, according to Rupert Sheldrake, who she references, is a non-material region of influence around a particular form. It holds memory and information, and over time it becomes easier for those entering the field to learn its behavior patterns. Fields have a collective memory in which all past members contribute to the energy in the field. The energy has a certain frequency or resonance around a person or a group. Judy sees a collective intention of compassion within a group as a field that attracts and encourages lower stages of consciousness to evolve more quickly. The scientific phenomena of entrainment, which she talked about in the introduction, what Einstein calls spooky action at a distance, or non-local communication, communication without crossing radio waves or without any tangible means of communication, and resonance suggests that the more we vibrate at the same frequency, the stronger the field will become, and the stronger the attraction will become, and the greater ease with which the field may be entered, creating a new harmony. This is what John Philip Newell was talking about in the book that we studied last year, A New Harmony. So anyhow, this whole idea of a field of compassion brought me back to remembering Daniel Smith Christopher, who was a scripture scholar from LMU, says that the creation story in Genesis was written to say that the God of the Hebrews created with intention and compassion, created with intention and compassion, unlike the gods of the surrounding nations who created out of war and conflict. Meister Eckhart in the 13th century said, "The first outburst of everything that God does is compassion. All creatures as offspring of God hold compassion in common. Compassion is our universal heritage, our God origin, our God destiny. Compassion unites us. It forms the common field of wholeness that all creatures share." This compassion, according to Thomas Merton, whose root meaning in Hebrew is the same as womb, we're birthed from a womb, of compassion with intention. He says this compassion welcomes the ungrateful and the wicked and all those who do not in some minds merit it. It goes on to say that this mercy or compassion is gratuitous. It considers no fitness, no worthiness, and no return. It is the love by which, excuse the language, male language, God seeks and chooses his chosen and binds them to himself. It is the love by which he is married to humanity, so that if humanity is faithless to God, it must still always have fidelity to which to return. You see, that's unconditional love. You don't have to respond. You're still loved. We live by the mercy of God alone. This compassion also denotes an excess, a prodigality in the way it is practiced. It signifies an excess of beneficence or goodwill, the exercise of goodwill toward one who has no right at all to claim it from you, and the exercise of goodwill to one who deserves it, but in greater measure than he deserves it. And this is the radical abundance of God's love. This is the root or source of our identity in God. We're bound to God in compassionate love. We live and move and have our being in a field of divine compassion. We were born from the waters of compassion, and our hearts are restless until they rest in compassionate union and interdependence with all of creation. A few hours before his untimely death, Merton observed, "Compassion is the keen awareness of the interdependence of all living things, which are all part of one another and involved in one another." So we participate in this ongoing story. Greg Boyle last week made a statement that really struck me when he was talking about these gang members. And he said, rather than judge them, we should stand in awe of the burden they carry. Well, that's not just for them. We all carry a burden of our history, our cosmic history, life, death, resurrection, pain, suffering, fragmentation. It's in every cell in our bodies. We carry it too. So we should not judge ourselves too harshly as we grope our way towards the fullness for ourselves and fullness of life. So I think this is compassionate love. I think this is the compassionate love with which we were birthed. And the freedom to become who we choose to be, all the possibilities and potentials to be who we're called to be, takes groping towards it. It's a trial and error. And this is why for Teilhard, original sin was standing in the way. We have to blame somebody or have a culprit for what is a natural process in which we all participate. So, in this whole understanding of the womb, the root meaning of the word, and two of the speakers last fall mentioned this. I think the one that spoke on Islam and the one that spoke on Judaism said in both of those traditions, the root word for compassion is womb. And so I was thinking about Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus when he says you have to be born again. And Nicodemus said, "How can we re-enter our mother's womb?" And he said, "No, it's not a material birth; it's a spiritual birth. So is the womb a metaphor for entering this place of compassion that holds all possibility and potential? And how do we do that?" And I think that's why silence is so important. I think silence is a metaphor for the womb or for compassion. This is what happened to me. When you make yourself open and available and ready and just show up and be present and believe that there's this field or there's this compassion that surrounds us and see it as a presence and a desire to be present to it. And I think it's a presence, but multiple presences of all people who have held compassion. in our hearts. And so that's why I think silence is a practice. It was for me. It was for me. If it hadn't been for silence, for that time that I spent every single day before my day started in silence, where I can enter into this space that is fertile with possibility and potential for myself and for others. So I think as a practice, silence opens the door for us to experience this field of compassion with which we're surrounded. And I think Word and Life is a field of compassion. If I look back on our history, Judy says in the book towards the end that there are four things that nurture this field of compassion. One is spaciousness, hospitality, openness. The other is contemplation, just focusing and intending towards our own growth and a higher good. And commitment, committing ourselves to the process of being open and growing. And then imagination. You have to think big and dream big. You have to have dreams. I think Martin Luther King and Gandhi, they all had the vision of unity. And so you work together then to try and create it. To me, science and spirituality, or science and religion, are two sides of the same coin. Science is, did we create the internet? Or was the internet there and we awakened to it? If the internet shut down tomorrow and we had no access to it, does that mean we're not connected? So we don't create a field of compassion here at Word and Life. We're starting to open to it. And so I think, you know, we would want maybe to take a look at where we might be going with this, and what might we be, if we are opening to this, how might we move into it, and how might we gather together, draw the circle bigger, I'll say, outside. The last week to me was a perfect example. I mean, there were people here from, you know, my Mormon neighbor up the street was here. There were people here from, it wasn't about religion. It was about compassion. Compassion is common to all religions. So Albert Einstein had a great quote. A human being is part of a whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires, to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion, to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. That was Albert Einstein. So, and this is one of the reasons why I love Teilhard, because he had a positive vision of the world, and because he believed we participate in our own future. And he was struck with the apathy of Jesus, the Christ, having been here 2,000 years ago, and we're still waiting in expectation. I learned this after the fire, with the amount of compassion in this community for those of us who lost our homes. I mean, it was clear to me then, you know, don't dream about it over there. Look, there it is over there. Look, there it is over there. It's among you. It rose up. Compassion rose up in the community and was visible. You know, so at any rate, that mirroring. And so back to my question, and I'm going to end here. And it's one I want to reflect on, and I hope all of us at Word and Life, and especially people committed to coming to Word and Life, is there more we're being called to do, and how can we do it? How can we grow the circle bigger? And how can we make visible this kingdom that Greg Boyle was talking about last week, where that they all may be one? I'm going to end with a poem by David White that I love.
part of it.
It's part of a poem, larger poem. Remember the way you are all possibilities you can see, and how you live best as an appreciator of horizons, whether or not you reach them. Admit that once you have got up from your chair and opened the door, once you have walked out into the clean air toward that edge and taken that path up high, beyond the ordinary, you have become the privileged and the pilgrim, the one who will tell the story, and the one coming back from the mountain who helped make it. Amen. Shall I?
We're going to be moving the tables into this area during the break, so please take your jackets and purses and things with you. And I would like any strong men in the audience to hang around and help me do the work.
Yeah, strong women are okay. But we have. Can we take a couple minutes? I don't want to leave without an opportunity if somebody has a question. One or two, I would like to take just a few minutes, because when we come back after the break, I want you to do your own sharing in groups. But just to have a minute, if anybody has one. If not, that's fine. Yeah, Terry.
When you talked about Shayard, and I thought that he would have invented the Internet, and Karen Armstrong is trying to do that, compassion.
Oh, yes. We studied her book in the fall. Okay, she's saying Karen Armstrong is saying the same thing in her book, and I was just acknowledging that we are continuing the study of compassion, and we started with Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, in the fall, which we studied. So it's taking off, because you know what? Compassion will rise. Why? Why will compassion rise? Because suffering is rising. I mean, the suffering is getting greater. Compassion rises at the same time.
You'll be able to hear me. I'm a loud mouth.
No, they like it on the tape. That way it can be on the tape.
I was sure everybody could hear me because I'm pretty loud mouth anyway. I wanted to ask, considering the overall presentation that you've given us, what consideration is given to the limitation of availability of the information? I stepped over the threshold 35 years ago, but I had no knowledge whatsoever of any availability, so I was walking blind, although I didn't think I was blind. Limitation that is provided by family. The 30 years that I've been walking it, I've been doing it alone. My wife and children think I'm crazy. Circumstances, basically financial or health imposed, availability of the whole concept, and physical limitations I mentioned, and emotionality. I mean, you know, the ability to assimilate the content because of emotional absorption, say.
I'm not sure I understand the last part of that, but...
Well, in other words, argumentativeness can really get in the way.
Well, okay, here would be my response to that, because I've experienced all of that. You change yourself, and the world around you changes. You move into it, it has to start in here. It has to start with the change in our hearts. And when we're more compassionate towards ourselves, and when we can find ourselves in the brokenness in the world, I think then the world around us changes. But you're not. It'll slowly. Believe me. And it may take. You may never even see it, but it'll change. I mean, I have personal experiences of many, many years with hanging in there. And
pursuing for 30 years at the. Generous behest of my wife, not the giving behest, but just, all right, go to your meeting. That sort of feeling about it.
Well, Well, you know, I had that experience many years ago when the kids were late teens, and I felt like nobody in my family understood me. And I got frustrated, and I remember one day I was frustrated with all of them, and I ran upstairs and I slammed the door and I looked up and I said, "To God, send me to a foreign mission somewhere. I want to go somewhere where somebody wants to hear about you and where I can make a difference." And the voice immediately came back and said, "You are in a foreign mission." I'm not kidding. That is what I heard. Turn around and go back down there. If you can't serve me here, where do you think you're going to serve me? And that was a long time ago, and it's not over yet, you know. So I continue to work on myself, and I'm becoming a lot more compassionate, and it's getting a lot easier for me to let the people I love be who they are. Amen. So, okay. Thank you for your question.